Welcome to the Surgeon Masters Podcast, where you can have a thriving practice while still having time to travel, connect with your family, take care of your health, and pursue outside interests. Each episode focuses on learning, understanding, and implementing effective habits that will allow you to create a sustainable practice and take care of your number one asset, yourself. Here's your host, Jeff Smith.
So we're going to go ahead and get started with Taylor Real. And Taylor is going to give us a presentation on dealing with responding versus reacting to our environment. And we just put a little sort of catchy line that would be appropriate to surgeons of how to cut it out, how to take control of that. And so, Taylor, I'm going to turn it over to you and let you share a little bit about yourself and fire away.
Thanks, Jeff. And hi, Joe. I really appreciate the opportunity to come and talk to the group. So my name is Taylor Ryle. My expertise, I'm a surgeon, and my expertise is in complex pancreatic surgery, but I love general surgery as well. I take out gallbladders and repair hernias and things like that. I've spent my entire career in academic medicine, and after 10 years at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston, I joined the faculty at University of Arizona Banner University Medical Center in Tucson in October, where my current role is the chief of the Division of General Surgery and Surgical Oncology. And I just recently became a certified professional coach. So today I'm going to talk about responding instead of reacting to your environment. As you probably heard, emotional intelligence is a big buzzword in the leadership world today. And emotional intelligence is really the ability to recognize one's own and other people's emotions, to discriminate between different feelings and label them appropriately, and to use that emotional information to guide our thinking and behavior. So emotional intelligence is really comprised of an array of non-cognitive skills, capabilities, and competencies that influence a person's ability to cope with environmental demands and pressures. And so if you read about emotional intelligence, it includes self-awareness, self-management, social awareness, and relationship management. But today I'm going to talk primarily about managing yourself, so about self-awareness and self-management. And I want anybody to feel free anytime I'm talking to cut in and stop me. This can be interactive. I'm more than happy to be interrupted. So I still get a little nervous when I talk to surgeons about this topic. I'm acutely aware that 2 years ago, I would have rolled my eyes if someone said emotional intelligence or mindfulness or well-being. And so I came to coaching and to talking to you today through my own personal experience. And so I'll just share a little bit of that so you know where I'm coming at this from. Anybody on the outside looking at my life 3 years ago would have thought I had it all. I had a great job, a great research group. I had a great husband. I looked really good on paper. But for almost 3 years, I'd really been teetering on the verge of burnout. So I just felt like I was constantly pulled in too many directions. I worked all the time and I was just exhausted. And so I felt like I was bad at everything I did. I felt like I was a bad surgeon, a bad investigator, a bad mentor, a bad teacher, a bad wife, a bad triathlete. Whatever, it didn't matter because I didn't have time to do any of those things well. And I would have these periods where I was okay. And then about a year and a half ago, for many reasons, which I'm happy to share, I really wasn't okay anymore. I was dangerously burned out. So coming to work was literally an effort and I could power through things, but I had lost all of my drive. I literally had to force myself to go in and to do the right thing for patients, for anybody really. And like I'm sure you all did, I went into medicine at some level because I wanted to help people. But instead, I literally hated people. I used to tell my husband, you know, some people hate cats. You know, I hate people. And I say this in jest, but I just had compassion fatigue. I had nothing left to give. And I almost walked away from surgery, from medicine, and my life as I know it. And at that point in time, I sort of felt hopeless because I felt like I had no other marketable skills. And I was a slave to the lifestyle that a career in medicine provided, and I just felt trapped. So I met a man named Robert on July 3rd of 2014, and Robert functioned in my life as a professional coach, and he profoundly changed my life. Robert's actually a sports psychologist. I met him by random luck at that time, and he teaches high-potential athletes to function at their very best through mindfulness and self-awareness. And so through working with Robert, through working with a woman named Tamber, who's one of my current coaches, and completing the professional coaching course at IPEC, where Jeff actually did his coach training, I've markedly changed my perspective and my ability to respond to my environment in a way that promotes my own self-being in my life. My coaches and other people who have sort of helped me in this process helped me realize that in each moment I have a choice. They're not always good choices, but I get to choose what I think, how I communicate, how I show up, and ultimately the results that I generate. And so while this has been an ongoing learning process for me, I can, on most days, integrate my personal and professional goals to create a life that fires me up instead of burning me to the ground. And as I worked with Robert over 6 months or 8 months, I realized what I wanted to do, and I wanted to take care of doctors. So in January, I enrolled in the certified coaching course, which is ultimately how I met Jeff. And my initial plan was to leave medicine and to work with physicians who experienced the same kind of burnout that I had. But as I learned more about the process, my vision and purpose became clearer, and I thought I had a real opportunity. So I wanted to use my skills as a surgeon, my national and institutional leadership positions in surgery, and my new coaching skills to really change the way we train residents and develop faculty. I have this idea that I can prevent burnout by creating an environment where high performance is achieved through well-being instead of just running faster on the hamster wheel until you burn out. So during my coach training, we learned a model called energy leadership. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about that today because it was sort of really important in how I was able to change the way that I respond to my environment. So one of the foundation principles that they teach us is that each moment describes who you are and gives you the opportunity to decide if that's who you want to be. And so when I first heard this, I thought, yeah, that sounds great. How do I actually do that? I realized I had a choice, but the time between any stimulus and my response was about a microsecond. And it was often not the way I would have liked to have responded. And so at that point in time, I really didn't know how I could create the time and consciousness, you know, create that space to actually make a choice. Because my reaction was just so ingrained. And the key is, you know, everybody says, well, the key is mindfulness, you know, and Robert would tell me that, and I'd say, well, mindfulness, you know, for me, that was just this abstract concept. And so as an athlete and a surgeon, I needed a process. Like, I needed a way to create awareness and then to make a different choice. And for me, this model was the how. So it gave me access to a process for awareness, and enabled me to start making choices in my life and doing things differently. So some of you may have heard some of this because I'm sure Jeff's talked some about it before, but I'm just going to briefly go through the model. And again, you know, feel free to stop me along the way, but the model describes 7 levels of awareness or energy. Again, I kind of hesitate to talk about energy to surgeons, but I think the surgeons that I've worked with sort of can really relate to the model and then, you know, put it actually into practice. And so a couple of things I like people to understand is that when I talk about different levels, none of those levels exist in isolation. So we all experience all the energy levels at different times, and we even experience different energy levels in response to the same event. And none of the energy levels are good or bad. Each has advantages and disadvantages. But what's neat is that those energy levels provide a framework that help you develop self-awareness. And the really cool thing is that when you get really good at it, and you really understand the energy levels, and you're aware of your own level of awareness at any given time, you can actually choose the energy level from which you want to respond. You can choose how you want to respond. And so this model just really provided this framework and this vocabulary for me to understand it and to be able to put it into practice. So when we talk about the energy levels, we talk about two kinds of energy. We don't call them negative and positive. We call them catabolic and anabolic. So you all are doctors, so you know the meaning of those words, but catabolic energy is that draining, resisting, contracting energy. And that catabolic energy can provide you with an energetic boost to combat what you perceive to be a stressful situation. But when you use it on a long-term basis, it imparts mental, emotional, and physical tolls that are really potentially destructive to you, your organization, and to the people around you. And I know that's true because I lived there for a couple years. Anabolic energy is just the opposite. It's constructive, it's fueling, it's growth-oriented, and it helps you move forward to achieve the results that you want to achieve and really lead others in the same direction. And you can kind of think of every thought that pops into your head as having this energetic consequence. And so while no energy levels are good or bad, that catabolic energy just feels worse. So it has a greater energetic consequence. It takes a greater energetic toll on you. The first two levels of energy are catabolic energy. Sadly, about 85% of people spend most of their time at level one and level two. So level one is what we refer to as victim energy. And so when I say victim energy, I'm talking about being at the effect of our thoughts and our feelings, our emotions, events. And level one thoughts include things like fear, worry, guilt, self-doubt, lack of confidence, low self-esteem. And different circumstances create that victim energy for different people. And I see it all around me in academic medicine. It's, you know, this place is terrible. You can't change it. That's just the way it is here. If only this would change or that would change. And when we experience that level one energy, we feel this sense of futility. So it's, I can't change it, so why bother? We don't have any sense of control over what's going on, and we either give up or we withdraw. So a year ago, I had so much level one energy, I just was constantly at the effect of things that were out of my control. For me, that energy still comes up now when I'm being pulled in too many directions, and I feel like I can't give my full attention to the things I need to. And you can see the obvious disadvantages of level one energy, but level one energy also allows people to protect themselves from harm or failure. And at level one, we don't have to take responsibility because nothing's our fault. So level two energy is conflict energy. And so surgeons know a lot about conflict energy. So at level two, you win and somebody else loses. So level two is black and white thinking. It's good or bad. It's right or wrong. And when people have a lot of level two energy, it's about being right. So when I wasn't at level one, I lived at level two. In fact, I mastered level two. So being right was a big thing for me. And I needed people to know I was right. And I needed to win. And somewhere along the line, I realized that being right isn't enough. Because if I communicate that way, right or not, nobody can hear me because they're busy running for cover. And there are advantages to level two. So when you're at level one, at least at level two, you're taking action and you're standing up for yourself. And at level two, you get shit done. But it's not sustainable because your ability to get things done is by force. And it leads to burnout because life is a battle. And it just drains your energy. And people listen because they're afraid and not because they're bought in. Level three is really the first anabolic level. And at level three, we start to realize that we're responsible for our own thoughts and feelings. It's also a level of forgiveness and rationalization. So when we have a lot of level three energy, we have strong coping mechanisms and we can release all that catabolic energy. So people with level three energy make lemonade out of lemons. They just make things work. And so while there were tons of things I couldn't control in my life, when I was able to shift my energy to level three and realize that I was responsible for my own thoughts, feelings, and actions, and that if I didn't like them, I could change them, it was a huge step. Just recognizing that I had a choice and then taking responsibility for that choice. So in life and in medicine in particular, I find people stuck in this level one, two, three loop. So we feel like we're constantly at the effect of things going on. This in turn creates resentment and anger and conflict. And it leads us to rationalize and cope just to sort of get along. And we create all these workarounds and then we end up back at level one. Level three is interesting because when you're coming from level one and level two, level three feels great. But as you start to spend more time in the higher energy levels, it can feel uncomfortable. And a downside to level three, while you can get along and you can cope with almost anything, we're often coping and surviving, but we're not really thriving. Level four is super important for doctors to understand. The core thought at level four is really concern for others. So as surgeons, you know, we win when our patients do well. As mentors and teachers, you know, we win when those we train succeed. And on some level, we all go into medicine because we want to help people. The disadvantage to level four is the compassion fatigue that I talked about earlier. So certainly, I went into medicine because I wanted to help people, but instead I hated them. And so if we continually give without taking care of ourselves, you know, we just find ourselves in that position where we don't have anything left to give and we feel resentful and angry. And then guess what? You know, we're no longer at level four. We're back at level two. I think the key to maintaining that level four energy is really learning to take care of yourself. So not necessarily putting ourselves before our patients or before others, but at least treating ourselves as good as we would treat others. And we're often our own worst critics, and we often don't take care of ourselves like we recommend that our patients should. Level five is this level of possibility. So people with a lot of level five energy see everything as an opportunity. Instead of problems and challenges, they see solutions and opportunities, and they don't make lemonades when they see the lemons. They think, oh God, lemons, you know, look what I can do with all these lemons. You know, they see all the possibility. And when you look across your lives and at mentors and people who inspired you, you know, the best teams I've worked on in surgery, from clinical service teams as a resident to multidisciplinary teams for patient care, are level five teams that function with level five energy. So where everyone's perspective is valued, you know, and the team can come up with better plans that often incorporate and build on each other's ideas, oftentimes creating solutions that are better than any one member could have come up with. Level five, you're not afraid of change because you just see all the opportunity in that. A disadvantage to level five is that you can sort of get caught up in those ideas and not move forward because you can't really create a plan or make a decision. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on level six and level seven. They're difficult to describe, but at level six and level seven, we're just completely in the moment. We're completely in flow. So for surgeons, this happens on a good day when you're in the operating room. You know, things are flowing. You don't need to ask the scrub tech for anything. Time just flies. An operation goes perfectly. For athletes, it happens when you're doing your thing. You know, so for me, it's riding my bike in the perfect backdrop of the Catalina Mountains, and you're just in that moment. And as soon as you realize and you start thinking about it, you're kind of not there anymore. So it's just sort of a brief overview of what the model looks like so that you can understand how that model works for me or how I actually use it to change how I respond to my environment. So as I learned the model and I started to think, you know, I found myself in this constant state of, like, I want to change it, but it's, you know, I would react badly and then I'd say, well, what did I just do? You know, and I would get so aggravated because I thought, well, how am I ever going to change that? And actually that process of saying, well, what did I just do was really the first step, you know, because before that I didn't even realize that I did something I didn't want. And so that first step is really stopping and recognizing that catabolic energy you know, and then the second step is really once you're able to sort of stop and recognize that things didn't go the way that you wanted, is really understanding why you had that response, then considering how you might respond differently, and then choosing how you want to respond. So as I started to understand the model, I had this idea, I was like, well, I don't want to have any catabolic energy. But that's actually not the right way to think about it. So that catabolic energy to me is actually a warning. And I actually feel that energy. I kind of feel it in my stomach, but some people will feel it in their throat or different things. But I use it now as a warning sign. It's my sign to stop and assess the situation. And it's a sign that I'm in one of those moments where I have an opportunity to choose. So instead of just not wanting to feel that, you know, you sort of can use that. And then the next step is really to assess what's causing that response. So what is the response? What energy levels are showing up? What emotions is that triggering? What's my interpretation of the events or the story that I'm making up that caused that? And then how would I respond from the different energy levels? And those energy levels just gave me a vocabulary and a framework to see the different ways that I could respond. Because when I was really stuck, I couldn't even see different ways to respond. And so I'll give you some examples of things that just sort of happened recently. You know, I was out a few weeks ago and I was running. They have this river path that sort of goes all along the water here in Tucson. And I was running and I was all the way over to my right. And this person came up behind me on a bicycle, you know, and he said, he yelled, "On your left," you know, and it's like all of a sudden I could feel myself get tense and angry, you know, and I was ready to kind of turn to the guy, you know, and just with some angry response. And I was like, wow, you know, why am I angry? You know, and in my mind, I was like, well, I'm all the way over to the right. So I didn't know what he wanted. And I kind of, in that moment, realized that was sort of a reflection of my past experiences. Because oftentimes when I'm riding my bicycle on the path, there's people walking four people across and I yell on your right, you know, on your left, and they won't move. And so I immediately assumed that he was angry at me, that I wasn't far enough over, that he was annoyed. And really none of that was true. And so in that moment, I was able to kind of stop and say, you know, how do I want to respond differently? And I was able to kind of right then and there, just, you know, wave at the guy, say, "Good morning," you know, and he said, "Oh, it's such a beautiful day," you know, and just smiled and kept going. So, you know, that whole reaction, and a year ago, I just would have put my hands up. I would have been like, "What do you want? What's your problem?" And the response would have been totally different. You know, when I work with residents and I work with people on sort of changing this and what we do every day here, we just go through examples. So, you know, when I was a resident, a nurse called me at 2 o'clock in the morning because I had taken a nasogastric tube out of a patient, you know, 14 hours ago. She called me up and she said, "You know, you didn't write to stop the NG tube replacement fluid." And I just went nuts. I mean, I was so angry. I was like, "Why are you calling me at 2 a.m? That's just the dumbest question ever." You know, and that's how I would respond in that situation. That was sort of my natural response. And so now when this happens or residents go through that, we sort of walk through the exercise. We say, okay, you know, that was a level 1 and level 2 response. I felt that victim energy. Why does this always happen? Why do they have to call me at 2 o'clock in the morning? You know, and I was angry. So then I think, well, how would I respond from level 3? I'd be like, "Look, you know, she doesn't know any better. I'll just deal with it. I'll just tell her to stop the replacement fluid and I can go back to bed." And from level 4, I would have had more concern for her. I'd be like, "Gosh, you know, I'm sorry you had to call me and ask me that. I should have done that before." And a level 5 response would really be, "How can I fix the system so that, you know, when I take out the NG tube, that order's automatically stopped and I won't ever get this call." And just sort of every time you have an event where it doesn't go the way that you want, or actually it does go the way that you want, it's sort of going through this process. So, you know, what energy level showed up? How could I have responded differently? And then And then as you do that over and over again, those choices become available to you in the moment. Now, they don't always become available to me in the moment. I don't always do that right. But I want to open it up to discussion from Jeff and Joe and anybody else who's on the line. I can give other examples of how I use it. But I think it's actually, if you really consciously do that every time these things happen, it really does help change the way that you react and respond.
So first of all, the two examples you gave are great. I actually also was pretty entertained by the timing, because right around that time I was thinking, boy, can you give a good example? And there you did. So, but that's a good situation where you're working with the residents and kind of giving them the examples, because, I mean, when you describe that, I can completely imagine that happening as far as the NG tube. There's plenty of things where there's a request for an order and you're like, well, that would be impossible, right? Since there is no NG tube anymore.
Right.
But just going through that framework of an example of that. So what, give us, I mean, I'll let Joe chime in too, but if he doesn't, you know, shortly, give us a couple more good examples like that.
Yeah, so I'll give you an example, Jeff, that happened a few weeks ago. And I know in my heart of hearts that this would have just gone so differently 2 years ago. So I've been here only 3 months. You know, I just started operating because it takes forever to get your privileges and all the nonsense. But you know, I had a case that got taken back to the operating room. So first of all, I had the flu and I was just exhausted and I had these other meetings and different things going on. And this patient that I had operated on, I did a revision of a Bill Roth II gastrectomy for a recurrent cancer. And so I had converted into a room, and he had come in the morning and he got sick, and he had, you know, he came in with this abdominal pain. They didn't really see anything on the CAT scan, but his pain was sort of way out of proportion. And in the morning, he looked okay. But around 7 o'clock at night, he spikes a fever to 39.9. You know, he becomes really tachycardic. And I was worried that he had an internal hernia. And so now I'm really sick. I'm really cranky. I'm really tired. I have this extra fear that, my God, this is one of my first cases here. They're just going to think I'm a terrible surgeon. So it's just all that level one energy. And I was like, okay, but, you know, the guy needs an operation. There's nothing I can do. But, of course, I was at the other campus, so I called the resident and I asked them to post the case. And they post the case. Now it's 7:30, and I get a call from the anesthesiologist, who I've never met. And the anesthesiologist says, well, you know, you posted this case, but Dr. K, you know, just posted a case, and he posted it at a higher level, so you have to wait. And so immediately, like, I feel that.
We've never
anger,
had that,
you know,
happen before.
But so immediately I get angry, you know, and I can just feel it. And I can tell you that 2 years ago, my response would have been, that's bullshit. You know, my patient's really sick, you know. I'm going to go first. You know, the resident posted it wrong. Like, I would have just gone nuts. And it would have been in the name of, you know, taking the best care of that patient. But, you know, having sort of gone through this process for so long, I was able to take a deep breath, and immediately I could feel that level three energy kick in, because I thought, well, you know, so what's the worst thing that happened? I have to wait a couple hours. You know, I'll still get to take care of my patient, and, you know, maybe his patient's sick too, and different things. And then I was also able to kind of think, well, why, you know, why that angry response? And in my head, it's like, you know, I create this whole story. I'm like, well, that other doctor, his patient's not even sick, and he just wants to go first. And I don't really know if any of that's true. It may be true, but I don't really know that. So, you know, then I'm kind of able to sit back and be like, well, in reality, I want the best thing for both patients. So if his patient's sick and my patient's sick, they both need to be taken care of. And a real response, you know, the best response is sort of that level five response where I learn about the situation and we come up with a solution that's best for everybody. So I said to the anesthesiologist, I said, do you have his number? You know, let me call him and I'll call you back. So then I let myself be mad for a few minutes and I called the other doctor and I said, hey, you know, you just posted this case. I said, I have a patient who's sick also and I just wanted to talk to you so that we can understand, you know, which patient's sicker and decide what we want to do. And it was amazing because he says to me, he's like, oh, my patient's not really sick at all. He said, I'm here all night anyway, so you can go first. And I had a laugh because it's like, you know, I could have gotten what I wanted either way, but the long-term outcome would have been really different. Because, you know, on my very first week here, you know, I would have gotten this reputation in the OR and they would have been like, oh, you know, she's just this and that and she wants to go first. And, you know, had I approached him with insisting that I go first, he might not have said the same thing. He might have reacted with that same energy because when I call people and I yell at them, that's what I get back. So 2 years ago, I just thought the whole world was angry. But the thing was, I was angry. And so when I would act that way, that's what people would give me back. So that's just another example that probably everybody can relate to.
Yeah, I mean, my longer-term example to that is that I work at three different hospitals doing trauma care. And one of the places, I mean, all the places I would say I come across is interested in taking my care of my patients, doing a good job, yada, yada, yada. But in one place, I'd have, you know, I probably had, you know, eight positive experiences and then had one where I kind of was like, you know, this is bullshit or, you know, some sort of confrontation. But then it's like, oh, wow, you know, something's weird because he's like really angry. And I, at the other hospital, when I started doing trauma stuff there, that was like within my first three cases. And I just noticed, you know, for honestly the next few years, I would tell people, I'd say, well, you know, I think I take care of people about the same at all three places, but at the one, I don't necessarily have the same reputation that I do as the other place because the one place, I think, you know, they have a little bit this sense that I do complain a lot, and yet I think it's relative. Now, like you said, it kind of all comes around, and what I've even describing to you is my perception. You know, it's not like I have this survey of what they think of me. This is what I think they think of me, but, you know, it makes a strange little loop. But
right.
I think what you pointed out, I have had tons of experiences where I've had that anger and then step back and, you know, I don't know if I had that much control. I do the things that I've learned through practice and created enough control and then had a conversation and been amazed how well the interaction went. But I also, you know, I mean, I guess one of my questions I would have for you is, you know, I have done that also, and then the response on the other end of the line was kind of exactly what I thought.
Sure, yeah.
You
and
know,
sometimes it is.
And then I realize, wow, I'm not sure if I'm in as much self-control as I thought I was, because that's not really the button that I wanted them to push. You know,
right.
So I'm just curious how you're dealing with the situation. I agree. The greatest part about doing and practicing the techniques that you've learned and I've learned is the frequency of that is less because sometimes it's just the few minutes of awareness that gets you past it. And sometimes, as you said, it can even be the few seconds of awareness. It all kind of depends on the situation. But have you had that come up and do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, sure. You know, and the thing is, you know, I could have very well called and he could have been like, my patient's sicker and I want to go first. And, you know, and then at that moment, you know, I have another choice to make, right? So I can either jump in the pool with him, right? And we can argue about it, you know, or I can decide, you know, that I'm just going to use a level 3 response. I'm going to be like, you know what, I'll just deal with it and make it work in this situation. And I think part of that then depends on really on the situation. So like in that particular instance, how sick was my patient, you know, and how much did I want to go now because I was tired, I didn't feel good? And how much did I want to go now because really if I didn't go right away, my patient was going to die. Mm-hmm. You know, and then I might choose one thing or the other. So it might be really important and I might choose to respond from level 2 at that point. Or I might say, look, really, it can wait a couple hours. And even though that's not what I want, I'll make that work, you know, in the bigger picture. And a lot of times I kind of think of, especially in a case where I can't change the outcome, like maybe in that case I could argue and get what I wanted. But in a case where I can't change the outcome, I kind of think of it as using like 60 pounds of energy to lift a 25-pound weight. You know, I can get really angry and really pissed off, but if it's not going to change the results, I just waste all that energy, you know, and so why bother? You know, I like that visual of using that 60-pound weight to lift a 25-pound weight because it's just, you know, when does it really, you know, why am I doing it? Because it's not going to change anything.
So that kind of alludes to something when you mentioned the, I like that example of that visual. I think one of the challenges with a lot of this stuff is with surgeons is we tend to be very logical thinkers. And speaking about reaction or the emotion, the anger, the frustration, whatever you want to call it, is almost talking about the illogical because you don't feel like getting mad, getting angry, getting sad is really what you're supposed to do as a surgeon. You're supposed to just get it done or, you know, deal with it, all sorts of different phrases. But in a practical sense, do you think that that a surgeon who doesn't know much about these ideas can use, or how would you describe that to a surgeon to say, okay, what's, you know, use a visual, what other, I guess I want to call them tricks or pearls, would you give a surgeon to say, to be, you know, the fancy phrase would to be more mindful in the moment, but the unfancy phrase would be to just create that awareness and then make a thoughtful, logical forward step.
Yeah, I think the first thing I tell, people was a couple things in what you said, you know, so one is that, you know, as surgeons, there are times when it's really important for us to be in control, right? So, you know, you're in a trauma, things are going downhill, like you need to be in control and you need to be right. But the problem is we bring that to every other part of our lives. So, you know, sort of recognizing, like I said before, like when it's really important to be right and when it's not as important to be right and being able to kind of let that go. So that's one thing I would say. And then the other is, you know, really sort of stepping back and when something happens, saying, well, you know, why did that happen? And really identifying the emotion. Because when I talk to surgeons, I'm like, well, how do you feel? And, you know, I get, they're angry, they're pissed off, but that's not really what they are. So, like, when I gave the example on the bike path, like, I wasn't really angry. I was indignant and I was defensive. You know, I mean, that's really what I felt. And then once I can kind of understand what I sort of initially label as anger is, I can say, well, why do I feel defensive? You know, well, I feel defensive because I think he thinks I'm, you know, blocking his way. Mm-hmm. And then I can understand my whole reaction. You know what I mean? But we're really good as surgeons about, you know, we have to push away those feelings so that we can operate, so that we can do what we need to do. And so just sort of becoming aware and, you know, having a broader range of emotions than, you know, angry or happy, or sad, you know, so, you know, what is that happiness? What is that anger? And I think that helps, because I think the first step is even recognizing it, because I couldn't even do that 2 years ago.
So, this is Joe. I have a question for you.
Yeah, Joe.
You know, I do some of this stuff, and believe me, I have gotten better at it over the years. I've got 20 years of experience as a surgeon, and, you know, I have really two things. One is today I did, you know, I could have reacted, as you said, rather than responded, and I think in both instances I was, you know, trying to get to level 4 or 5 and did a pretty good job. But in one particular instance, I looked at the response, and I'm trying to change or look at changing processes or dealing with processes in a surgery center. And I've been there for about 9 months or so. The guys who own it, the surgeons who own it, are notorious for being very vociferous and demanding. I'm not one of them, thank goodness. But at the same time, I looked at trying to look at a process today and realized that there wasn't as much impetus from the institution to look at the process or even potentially change it, even though I was trying to respond in a very positive, potentially fruitful way. So my question is, do you find institutions that have poor energy or poor energy usage and responses? And, I mean, how does that affect the individual? And the reason I ask that is because I was in what I thought was a very dysfunctional institution several years ago, and I got the sense of a very negative energy that, even though I was in a position to be able to possibly make some changes, I could get no changes made. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes total sense. And, you know, if you're truly in an organization that's just stuck in that level one, level two place, you may not be able to make changes. You know, but if, you know, in the situation you describe, I don't know that that's the case, but, you know, when I came here, there's, in my division and my department, there's tons of that catabolic energy. And, you know, so the first time I go to do anything, like you said, you know, you go to change a process or whatever, and the response is just like, we can't do it. You know, it can't be changed. That's just the way it always is here. But what I find is, you know, staying in my own anabolic state and just being really persistent with my message over time can shift that, you know. And if it can't, then I'm not in the right place, which is part of the reason I left my other job. Not the entire reason, but, you know, so just sort of seeing, and then also being able to find in that organization, you know, I don't know what your specific situation was, you know, but, you know, who were you talking to? Were they the right people? Are there other people who share, you know, share your vision for what could be instead of what is currently?
Correct. Correct. Well, and that kind of leads to the next question, which is, okay, so let's say that we have, I won't say mastered because that's more than what it really is, but we've gotten to the point where we are responding appropriately rather than reacting. And it doesn't have the desired effect, doesn't seem to get things going in the appropriate direction. Have you seen that type of thing where it basically allows people and processes to not change because you have?
Did that one more? Did you get that, Taylor? I don't know if I understood that.
Yeah, I was going to ask again. So you're
saying
I've changed. Okay.
Yeah, let's say you changed in the way that you're responding and you're no longer reacting. I mean, there are, I mean, I'm sure you've been in them. I've been in them in the university setting or whatever, where the people who reacted tended to get things done and people to look at them and bow to them. Now you've changed and you've become more of a responder rather than a reactor. And because of that, you have less effect on the system and you get less attention paid to you. So you end up sort of allowing the institution to be dysfunctional because you're responding in a positive way rather than being like the other reactors.
So the squeaky wheel's getting the oil.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think when you sort of make major changes like that, you know, that culture change, you know, takes a while. So again, you know, you can't control other people's behavior. You can't control how other people respond. So only you.
Correct.
And the way that I find that things change here is that, you know, I come in and I sort of talk to different people about it and we sort of change one at a time. And then as you get this critical mass of people who are responding and not reacting, you stop tolerating that kind of behavior. But it's not something that happens overnight, and you're absolutely right. You know, as you do that, this person who's complaining all the time may start to get that, but you would hope that over some long period of time that the system's not going to tolerate that anymore. You know, that may or may not be true. And that, like I said before, that just may be a function of that culture can't change there. I don't know. What do you think, Jeff?
Well, I mean, there's definitely a lot of issues there, but just to take a couple simple points, I think looking at it from a self-reflection standpoint, so that means even you as an individual, Joe, I would say that your process is gradual, right? So if you looked at becoming more of a responder, and you even use the word sort of mastering, you know, that's one of our challenges is we think things can be mastered. Well, even if you just do it on a relative scale, you're at a certain point in your progress in that. Well, if you look back a half a year, you look back a year, you look back 2 years, whenever you started making either an unconscious or conscious effort to do that, you were at some point in that transition. Well, that's everybody else too. So even if they are starting to respond better themselves, they may be in a very early point because they've been there for 10 years or they've, you know, whatever period of time that they've been under that leadership and you've been there for nine months. So giving a little bit of slack for that and then realizing that, you know, so individuals and then the system. And so I look at it, again, this is, you know, I'm getting very philosophical now because I'm challenged with this just like you are. I mean, I think we all have these systems, right? But I look at it, you know what really makes a difference is when you keep practicing it anyways. So an example that you go in there and the 10th time you get the same response, you still remain calm and you still say, hey, I really think we should look at this process. And I would love to sit down with somebody that actually agrees with me, you know, however you do it. And I think when you show that consistency, that one, you're staying positive anyway, so it helps you. And then two, I do think it starts to make an effect. And then I totally agree with Taylor's comment where you start to affect the people around you. And if there's a second surgeon or a third that are dealing with things in a way similar to you, it starts to show the comparison and say, well, wait, people can really want to do the right thing and try to do it in a way without screaming and yelling. Again, I think that's really hard. And believe me, I've been complimented for being very patient. And I've been amazed at how impatient I can be. So I think it all depends on what energy I'm kind of coming into the situation. You know, and when I can maintain that patience, I think I do a better job.
And Joe, too, like that, I hear in, go ahead.
That makes a lot of sense. And, you know, as you were saying that, one of the things that just came to mind is I'm, to a certain degree, being asked to go into a hospital here in the near future and be a positive contributor to a culture change that the CEO is trying to bring in to a kind of inbred group of physicians in a smaller hospital. And, you know, I look at it and say, you know what, I am definitely going to have to learn and be on my best behavior for being a responder if a culture change is going to come about and be positive.
Yeah. And too, Joe, you know, in what I heard you saying too, you know, it's like, you know, we're all sort of in this ongoing process, as Jeff points out. And so, you know, we sort of talk about our own progress, but then, you know, when things like that happen, it sucks us back into that level two energy, you know, and I heard that even in you. You're like, well, it's just not fair because then this person's whining and they're getting what they want, you know. So we have this sort of natural tendency to kind of pull back to that place where we judge that, we get angry about it. And so it is, it's just this ongoing process. And I think Jeff's right. The more we practice it, the more we understand how hard it is for other people to make those changes. And, you know, we understand that that process takes a long time. And we understand that the only way to get there is with persistence and that culture shift takes a long time.
One of the things that also came up in our earlier conversation, you were talking about the energy levels and what people that have been dealing with these concepts for more years than Taylor and I have talk about is the control is in that you can often be aware what energy level you're at, and then you can actually choose the energy level that you want to respond in. And so if you step back and you make a choice of coming back in anger, then, you know, that isn't necessarily a bad thing. Again, I'm not advocating that
sure
would be your response to this, but by having the control, you have sort of an inner peace or an inner spirit about you that knows that you made that choice. Now, you can look back and you can say, well, that was a bad choice or a wrong choice. But you also can look back and say, well, that was the choice that at the moment I felt was what was most appropriate and what for me and my situation or my patient was the best. It's complicated in that way, but it's also just going through the process in that fashion, I think, really helps me. Like, I can say I got angry, but wow, it took me 30 minutes of really trying to be reasonable and responsive instead of 5 minutes before I got angry. And knowing that going into the next situation, I don't consider myself a failure that, hey, every time I encounter this, I'm going to get angry, I'm going to be a failure. And so it almost self-perpetuates. Whereas if I go in saying, hey, let's see if I can get to even a longer period of time of patience and frustration before it really hits my boiling point, and hopefully I never get there because the issue gets resolved in 20. You know, I mean, so I think, and then I look at it as a opportunity for me to keep getting better and dealing with those situations. And the reality is by doing that, the circumstances tend to go better because I'm coming at it with a better approach rather than 5 minutes into it being completely angry.
One of the things I think about a lot, Jeff, is just this idea of recognizing my emotional response, but not judging it. So instead of being like, well, why did I get angry? Or, you know, in a judgmental way, it's more with curiosity, you know, like, well, why did that just happen? You know, and what can I learn from it? And it's not necessarily a bad thing to get angry, you know, that it's just, like I said, sort of there to teach me something. And so kind of getting away from that idea of judging that emotion or good or bad, but just really learning from it. So I have this whole idea, you know, coming into this job, and that I just sort of approach everything with curiosity, you know. So I try when I have a good day, a good event, a bad event, I try not to label it that way, but just be like, hey, you know, well, what did I learn from that? You know, what can I learn from that? So I kind of always try to shift to this place of curiosity. And if you really believe that, you know, and somebody else behaves in a way that makes you angry or whatever, you know, if you really believe that everybody's making the best decision they can make with their current level of awareness, you know, you can kind of judge them less also, which helps me some of the time, because I've made a lot of decisions that other people wouldn't view as good, but I believe they were the best I could do at the time with the information I had and that level of awareness I had.
Can I say something that's more self-aware, or more opening myself up than I really intended to? But I think both, especially because both of you are choosing to be coaches, I want to kind of come at it from that point of view, giving you the idea that comes from people like me. I consider you guys very, very lucky to be able to get angry, to be able to go and express it, maybe not even judge it, just have it, maybe reflect on it, maybe just let it go. Because there are those of us who have been sanctioned for such a thing, and we no longer have the opportunity to do that. I'm self-sanctioning now that because it happened in the past that I was sanctioned for it. Now I don't allow myself that opportunity because I don't want to be at risk of sanction again, I guess I should say. And so, right or wrong, I look at it kind of as the only opportunities I have are really for other responses.
Let me interrupt you there for a second, because I think you have a great point, but I wanted to point out something. So I understand what you're talking about, and I understand that there could be other surgeons out there that have had some sort of reprimand or sanction that feels like it's limiting the response. So it
Correct.
Can be an all or none, meaning you've said to yourself, that is going to be zero because I don't want to go through that again. But then I would challenge you and say, okay, so given that extreme restriction, that is a humongous burden, because everybody should be allowed to get angry. Now the question is, where could you express or feel or show that anger outside the system so you allow it for yourself, but not necessarily in an environment where you don't want it present? You know what I mean? Like, how could you do that so that it's not a complete turnoff or a complete shutdown of an emotion?
Oh, believe me, I have my outlets outside in sports and other things, but I'm not allowed. And it's not just me censoring myself. I, you know, because that sanction is so visible to any place that I go, you know, the other side of that is to instantly be labeled and possibly brought up again because of the history. Does that make sense?
Yeah. But you go a little bit to the point. And again, so sports and outlets, I mean, I get that. But, like to me, there has to be a place at work. Like, you go in the bathroom and, you know, yell at the mirror or something. I mean, to me, like I said, if I couldn't get angry at work, I'm not sure, you know. And again, I don't ever want to, and I strive to never take that out on anybody. But just like if somebody said, well, you can't get angry, I'd say, okay, that's really interesting. And how am I supposed to do that? So,
good point.
I mean,
what I have chosen to do is basically go and try to make a positive process-oriented move with the right administrators or charge nurses or whoever is really in charge of that aspect. I'll go, I'll make my point, you know, I'll try and be as rational as I can, et cetera, and then I have to drop it. And I have to let it go and be comfortable with the fact that I said my piece and let it go, and let the anger part of it go too.
Right.
Let the frustration go. And that's one of the blessings of having had the sanction in the past, is that in a way, even though I feel censored, I also feel like I can let go of things like I couldn't do before.
Well, yeah, and the way you just said that, I actually saw that as quite a positive, that you go in, you get your point across, you then walk away letting it go. Now, interestingly, in a historical situation, you could have gotten angry, your point might have gotten across, and they still wouldn't have changed. So in other words, nothing changed either way except for you, and all the benefits are to you.
Correct. And
right?
In a
so
way,
that,
that's
quote,
kind of,
worst case scenario. Best case scenario, somebody might actually listen. Right.
Well, that's the silver lining
of the sanction.
Right, right.
But
so it's taking a positive out of
Joe,
a tough situation.
Yeah, but I would ask you too, like now that you communicate differently, it's, you know, how much more often do you think that people actually hear what you say, and that you can make changes compared to, you know, sort of always approaching things in an angry state, you know, not that you always did, but, you know.
That's a good question that I can't really answer right, because I was in a different institution in a different situation before, and I am not in that now. And the institutions that I am in now at least appear on the outside to be more amenable to my my message. Now, that may have been because the message before was too angry and now it's not, or it could be a relationship of the people and the institutions are different. I haven't figured that out.
And it may be some of both, but you know, one of the things I found is sort of not just in my job, but just in sort of all aspects of my life, like people respond to me differently. It, you know, a few months ago we were at the airport and we're in this like just convenience store, you know, in the airport. And this woman just said to my husband, he's like, "Oh, your wife is so happy." And I swear that nobody's ever described me that way, you know, but it's like just this different vibe that I put out, you know, and that's what people think now, and they didn't think that before. And so I think part of what you are experiencing, you know, is the change that you've made and is the way that you approach people, you know, so that they can hear your message.
And I appreciate that too. You're absolutely right. The old institution I was in, there were several of us doctors near the OR that were getting into the elevator, and this lady walked in and she said, "You know what? You guys just need to go home, and you guys need to get some rest, and you need to get some relaxation. Everybody here around here is so fired up and on a string that you guys are like guitar strings. You know, you don't know how to handle the stress." And it was funny at the time. We just kind of, almost in a way, kind of blew it off. But then, you know, now being in a different place, I look back at that and I go, you know what? That lady saw a whole lot more of the whole institution. She was a family member of a patient than the rest of us could see.
Yeah, it's really remarkable to me that, you know, I mean, I changed jobs, but the truth is that nothing in my environment changed, like not the level of stress. And in fact, I think I'm under more stress, but only my perspective and my ability to respond to it changed, and my whole world changed. You know, my relationship at home, my relationship with my husband was good, but it's even better now. And it's just it's been a really interesting process for me.
So Taylor, let me,
how much of that do you
go for it, Joe?
I have a question for you. How much of that do you think may be attributable to for lack of a better term, hitting the bottom, surviving it, and coming back, and realizing that by doing that, you know, you can pretty much do whatever you want to or need to.
You know, that's a great question. I ask that question all the time because as I, like, I just have this idea that, like, why do we wait till people get where I was? You know, so, like, how can I teach this to residents and how can I teach them to go out equipped to deal differently with the stresses in their environment? And I would be curious what you think, Jeff. I ask that all the time. I'm like, is that something that I can teach them and prevent it? Or do they have to reach that same point before they can make that kind of change? And I don't know the answer.
Yeah, I don't profess to know the answer, but I obviously have the mission or goal to teach it before people get to that point. I also a little bit have the reflection that I think you can reach a mini bottom in the sense that on like one particular issue. I mean, you may have a personal bottom, or you might have a professional bottom, and then, you know, you use that to positively impact all the other parts of your life. And I think I picture it more as kind of the rolling hills and not big crashes. Like, I've had a life that I think about some of the experiences that other people have where they in various sort of ways have hit a bottom. And I go, that's not really my life. But the stress and the burnout kind of subtly there of kind of the rolling hills. Yeah, things are going pretty well, and then no, things kind of really suck. What other careers can I get into? You know, that kind. And I think those bottoms can teach you that you don't have to live that way. You know, you said in the very beginning of your presentation kind of that level three in survival. I think, you know, we do bounce around in energies, but I also think that when I talk to a lot of surgeons, there are a lot of that their whole focus is on just surviving. Just get through this career, make a living. I just want to survive. And I think the difference is, like you said, between surviving and thriving. And I think most of us would rather be thriving. So I think there's definitely opportunity for people not to do it, but I don't think it hurts. And I don't think that, I mean, I think there's plenty of examples of people rebounding exceedingly well from hitting, you know, close to bottom.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's a certain peace, I think, when you hit the bottom and come back that wasn't there before.
Yeah, sure, sure.
Absolutely.
And some of the positive thinking says to look at that as not to be scarred, not to, you know, not to come to conclusions that if you make that same decision or same choice that you're always going to get that point, because then that's kind of a scar, right? And I think we all walk around with some little scars, but if that makes you not do something again that you really want to do, then that's not ideal. But if you gladly don't want to do that again, I think that's a whole different story. So, Taylor, I was going to, and Joe, if you have any other thoughts, comments, please say, but there was something really interesting that you said that kind of caught me, and I describe myself as someone who's kind of in the early phases of maturing in emotional intelligence.
Yeah,
and you had talked about your example, and I think it's true of some surgeons. I think there's some of us out there that are pretty advanced, and I envy them. But you know, your bicycle analogy, and then later saying, "I wasn't angry; I was indignant." I think I would, you know, self-reflecting, I'd say, you know, part of the problem I have, and maybe others who are challenged with this as well, is we're almost too simplistic. Like, we can't differentiate nuances. Like, it's anger or it's happiness, or it's, you know, almost like, you know, three or four emotions. Whereas you pointed out, well, I'm angry. That's what it feels like. But when I step back, I can actually separate out what kind of anger it is. And maybe I'm going to rephrase it because it's actually not anger. And I thought that was really interesting. And I thought that that may be an opportunity for myself to self-improve, to look for other ways to describe it.
I had to work really hard to start doing that. And like, you know, because I would bundle a bunch of stuff in the angry category, you know, and so like a big thing that I would have called anger is really embarrassment, you know, or uncertainty, you know, so like I would get in a situation where I would like have forgotten something or not done something right. And I would feel embarrassed about that. And I would get angry and defensive, you know, so this sort of exercise for me in really naming that emotion, because then I, once I can really understand what it is, then I understand why I had the response I did, you know, so like I'll get angry at my secretary because, you know, she forgot something, but really I'm sort of angry and embarrassed that I forgot, you know, and I can kind of make more sense of it if I can really do that. And I have your lap, I'll send it to you, but I have this like a little emotion wheel. And it like, you know, it starts out with things like anger, but then it gives you like lots of other emotions. And it's an interesting
cool thing.
Yeah, I'll send it to you. It's really, it is cool.
Well,
that was actually the point.
Yeah.
That was actually the place that I was going to go with it, was that emotion wheel, if you've seen it, mainly because
no.
I was in with my boys when they were having some counseling done. And one of the first things that the counselor did was teach them as young boys to figure out what emotion they're really going for, that not everything is anger. There's frustration, there's angst, there's anxiety, there's all these different ones.
Right.
And you have to be able to label it first before you can then deal with it. And that was really a cool thing for, I mean, even for me at my age, to see that and realize that, you know what, I don't handle the names as well as I should, and because I can't label it, it's harder to deal with until I can.
So let me, as we kind of wrap up, because I think we got, you know, three people that are really enjoying this conversation, and if we had unlimited time, we could go on forever. But just in sort of a potential closing, can you, like, just share with us one more example of your responding versus reacting?
Sure. You know, so here, I'll give you an example where I reacted just recently and I didn't respond the way I would have wanted to, you know, so my husband's a saint. But he's an engineer. And so he's like super, super slow, and super methodical. And so, you know, I'm leaving for work the other morning. I had to be here at 6:30, you know, so I got up at, you know, 4 o'clock to exercise, and I'm running, you know, tight on time. And I get in the car and I realize I forgot my swim bag, you know, for later. So, you know, he's at the garage door. I'm like, can you just go get my bag? It's in the bathroom. So I sit there and I'm waiting, and he takes forever, you know, just forever. And I'm like, you know, so I'm already getting angry. I'm like, I could have just done it myself, you know, whatever. And then he comes back and he's like, I can't find it, you know? And so I got angry, you know, I jump out of the car, I like storm in there, you know? And it wasn't exactly in the bathroom. It was in this like little laundry room that was off the bathroom, and, you know, it was sitting right there, but, you know, he can't see things if they're not moving. But, you know, and I sort of stormed back to the car, and I left, and it's like, as soon as I left, I'm like, seriously, you know, I acted like that. And I was able to sort of walk through and think, well, you know, he couldn't find it. He didn't have it. You know, my level three response should have just been like, okay, I'll just go get it myself. It's not a big deal, and move on and not waste all that energy, right? And then my level four response would have been like, well, God, I didn't even tell him the right place to look. So how would he have known that it was in the laundry room and not in the bathroom? And, you know, I don't have a particular level five response for that, but, you know, instead of making, you know, here's someone I love, instead of making him upset, you know, I could have just gotten it myself. You know, I could have just gotten out of the car. It would have taken me the exact same amount of time, but it wouldn't have created all that stuff. And so when I have those moments, I'm equally open and honest about those moments, you know. And then I called him and I said, you know, I'm really sorry. And I know you can't always just say sorry and make it go away, but actually the next time it happened, I didn't do that. And so, you know, I become more and more aware of those things and how I interact with him. So that's another example, a recent one.
And so if you say that to an audience of surgeons and you get a little bit of a reaction of like, okay, why are you guys talking about this? I mean, let's just learn to operate. I mean, what can you say is in it for them? What can you say that motivates them to be interested in this topic and actually not just be interested and listen, but actually, you know, some sort of action plan, something to move forward?
Yeah, you know, Jeff, like, so I really just started talking about stuff, and I have to say that, you know, I expected that reaction, but that's not at all the reaction that I've been getting. You know, what people have asked me is like, well, you know, if you had approached things this way, you know, would you have been as successful as you've been? Because there's this like group of surgeons who believe that, you know, I got where I am because I was the way I was, and that now I can be here and sort of step back and do all this. And it would, you know, but I wouldn't have gotten there without being the way that I was. And so, you know, I kind of addressed that question, and because I truly believe that if I knew this 10 years ago, I would have been far more successful, you know, than I am. And I can't prove that, you know, I don't know. But I mean, I guess I just come at it from this standpoint of, you know, if nothing else, it just changes my satisfaction with work every day. You know, I just come in, my whole life is happier. You know, I go to the airport and people think I'm a happy person, and you know, people aren't afraid when I order dinner at a restaurant, you know. there's some people I'm sure who won't listen, and that's okay.
So you have any other, you know, last questions or follow-up comments?
No, I think the last one was a very good one about whether you would have gotten to where you are. I think one of the things that may also point out is the changing face of surgery, and the fact that the new surgeons coming out are much different than a lot of the older surgeons, you know,
they are.
Who were that. And the newer surgeons are probably a little bit better at balancing their lives than we used to be. And so, you know, it's a culture change happening in surgery, but I also think that there are probably a significant number of them out there who underlying realize that they do have issues with anger, frustration, whatever it is, you know, frustration with the system, et cetera, you know, and would benefit from this significantly. And you'll just have to find those people in there. And a lot of them are hidden.
Yeah, and I think a lot of them go back and think about it. You know, it's surprising, like, I'll get all these emails, like, after I give a talk. Like, nobody will say anything, you know, during it. And then, you know, 15 minutes later, I got 30 people in my office, you know. So it's an interesting thing. But the younger generations are actually really open to it. You know, the residents
right.
and stuff, they really eat it up. And so I think the time is right.
Yeah, I have so much more I could say, want to say, but I think it's an ongoing discussion, and I think it's a awesome topic. I really appreciate you presenting for us today, and you know, I told you before our call that we were going to record this to also make it a podcast and available to others to you know, learn from and get into the conversation. Do you have any closing thoughts you would want to make?
No, I appreciate everybody's time. I really appreciate the feedback also. Thanks.
Well, good luck to you over there in Arizona. I was there 99 through 2001 in abdominal transplant. And I loved Tucson.
Oh, Tucson's amazing. We really love it.
Yep, I missed being over there. My ex-wife didn't like it much, but it was a great place, and the university was actually pretty good at that time.
You were a transplant surgeon?
Yeah.
Yes, I did abdominal transplant, liver, kidney, and pancreas. So I worked with Paul Nakazato and while we were there. It was before the pancreas guy came as the chief of surgery, et cetera. So it was a good time, but anyway, I ended up going into private practice after that. Good luck to
you.
Well,
it was very – thanks. It was a lot different than when you were here. Lots of challenges. It was really nice to meet you.
You too.
Thanks again, Taylor. Thanks for joining us, Joe, and look forward to talking to both of you guys in the future. We'll sign
thanks,
off
Jeff.
And wish everyone a good night.
All right. Bye-bye.
Good night.